meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. Somehow that kind of got left out of the greeting cards and the motivational posters. You sort of feel like the Bible should be a bit more, I don't know, happy about things. You know, isn't it supposed to be about good news? But this doesn't seem to be good news at all. Meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. The speaker here is identified as the teacher, but he's not one of those sort of inspiring, idealistic teachers that Hollywood makes movies about. You know, the sort of one who moves to an inner city school and, you know, where all the kids are running amok and they're drug addicts. But he sort of, through the strength of personality and the joys of learning, inspires them and uplifts them and helps them to stare down adversity, triumph over the odds. He's not that kind of teacher. He's more the philosophy professor, the jaded philosophy professor who's seen thousands of freshers walk into his lecture theatre, filled with idealism, but basically thoughtless about life. But when we walk into his classroom, he won't let us get away with it. He's heard all the easy answers, he's explored them, he's pondered them, he's chewed them over and spat them back out again. It's kind of like Socrates, always forcing us to think, always challenging our assumptions, rejecting our easy answers, and insisting that we face the reality of life. And what is the reality of life, according to the teacher? Meaningless, meaningless. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. You could think, all right, well, I know that this is the start of the book of Ecclesiastes. And, you know, maybe he sort of progresses through it and comes out at the end and says, guess what? It's not meaningless after all. Well, no, not exactly. In the last chapter, chapter 12, verse 8, he repeats what he started with. Meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. And then the editor steps in for his afterword and says, not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. So the teacher actually gets the tick of approval at the end of the book. The editor says, yeah, this guy's right. But I suspect if you ask most people, they would say that the teacher is wrong. Life is not meaningless. If we just sort of walked out here into the law courtyard and did a random poll of people there and asked them, do you think that your life is meaningless? I suspect 99% of them would say no. No, I think my life is meaningful. What I do matters. My decisions, my actions, they really count. So if that's kind of instinctively what most people believe, why does the teacher insist that life is meaningless? If you've got your Bibles there, you can have a look at verse 3. And this is really the big question that the teacher asks, the big question he's trying to get to the bottom of in this whole book. What does man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun? That's it. What does man gain from all his labour at which he toils at under the sun? He's asking, what's the point? Why would you bother doing anything? What do you actually gain from all your efforts? What impact do you think you'll make on the world? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow to the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. You see what he's saying? It just doesn't matter what you do. Everything just goes on the way it always has, round and round and round and round. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again, and what has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. There's no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. In Nausea, the famous novel by Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existential philosopher, the main character, Antoine, starts thinking about the meaning of his life. And as he starts thinking, he starts spiralling downwards and downwards and downwards into despair, because he looks at everything that fills up his life and everything that fulfills his life. His work, his writing, his friendships, love, sex. And he realises that they are all literally meaningless. There's no point to any of them. He comes to the same realisation as the teacher. What does man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun? Nothing. Try as hard as you might, you can't actually profit from life. You can't gain from it. There's nothing you can take out of it. No lasting benefit. Nothing you do lasts, and all of it is completely undone by death. Life just goes round and round and round and round. And Antoine becomes nauseous. He feels physically sick at it. That's what the teacher's experiencing here. Nausea. Everything just spins round and round. Nothing matters. It's got that horrible, sinking, vomity feeling. Because he's thought and thought and thought about life. And no matter how he slices or dices it, he always comes up with the same result. Nothing matters. Life is meaningless. It's important to realise that what leads to this kind of existential nausea is not living life, but thinking about it. See, you can keep busy. You can just kind of mindlessly go through life without ever really thinking. You know, you wake up, you have breakfast, you go to uni, you go to a lecture, you hang out with some mates, go to another lab, then you head off and you hit the clubs for the night, you go get smashed, go home, sleep it off, wake up the next morning, have breakfast, go to uni, go to a lecture. And the teacher looks at all that and he says, you're busy. You're very busy. But what does any of it mean? What does any of it matter? What difference will you actually make? What will you have to show for all your busyness? See, imagine someone says to you, look, after this talk, what I want you to do is to go out to the oak lawn and just stand out there for half an hour and just wave your hand. Just stand there waving for half an hour. What would you say? I presume you'd ask, why? What's the point? What benefit will there be to me standing there waving my hand for half an hour? What benefit to anyone? And the teacher says, see, you'll ask that question about how you'll spend half an hour on a Monday afternoon, but you won't ask it about your life. Socrates famously said, the unexamined life is not worth living. The teacher says, well, that's true. But what makes you think the examined life is worth living? If anything, the thoughtful person is worse off. With much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. At least the person who never actually thinks about life can kind of enjoy it in a raw sort of mindless animal kind of way, blissfully unaware of how meaningless it all is. But the thoughtful person doesn't have that luxury. What is the point of your life? When it comes to an end, what will you have actually achieved? UWA says achieve excellence. But why? What's the point? At the moment, you're living life under the sun, to use the teacher's phrase, but pretty soon we're all going to be under the ground. And what will any of your achievements matter then? At the moment the lights go out, when the last breath rattles through your throat, Who cares? Not you. You'll be dead. Doesn't matter how excellent you might have been. You don't get to take anything with you. You don't get to take your graduation certificate with you when you die. You don't get to take your house or your car or your friends or anything. You'll have spent your whole life, and in the end, you'll have achieved exactly the same thing as everyone else. Nothing. So what's the point? Now, really, what is the point? You can go through life without ever actually asking that question. But if you're not asking that question, you're not really living thoughtfully. You're just, if you're not living thoughtfully, you're not even really living as a human. You're just living like an animal, just running off instinct, rushing around from one thing to the next. People have tried to come up with various solutions to the problem of life's meaninglessness. And the teacher tackles them one by one, and he just throws them to the ground broken. The first school of thought is hedonism. The hedonist says, we can find meaning in life by finding what gives us pleasure and living for that. It's like the atheist bus campaign in London. There probably is no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. It all sounds kind of liberating. The only problem with it is that if it's true, if there really is no God, then it's very hard to really enjoy life. Because as soon as you actually start to think about it, the enjoyment just sort of evaporates. C.S. Lewis, the author of the Narnia stories, among other things, points out, you can't, except in the lowest animal sense, be in love with a girl if you know, and keep on remembering, that all the beauties both of her person and of her character are a momentary and accidental pattern produced by the collision of atoms, and that your own response to them is only a sort of psychic phosphorescence arising from the behaviour of your genes. You can't go on getting any very serious pleasure from music if you know and remember that its air of significance is a pure illusion, that you like it only because your nervous system is irrationally conditioned to like it. You may still, in the lower sense, have a good time, but just insofar as it becomes very good, just insofar as it ever threatens to push you from cold sensuality into real warmth and enthusiasm and joy, so far you will be forced to feel the hopeless disharmony between your own emotions and the universe in which you really live. He's saying that the only way you can really have both atheism and real pleasure is to stop thinking. But at the point you've stopped thinking, you've stopped being human. No, if you want to be thoughtful and really enjoy life, you can't be an atheist. The second, and at first glance more noble sort of position, is that of the humanist, the person who says, I'm here to make the world a better place. Now, you hear this all the time in funeral speeches, especially when it's the funeral of someone young and someone's made the poor decision to let their friends speak. And you hear it come out. You know, Jane made the world a better place. Our lives were enriched by hers. She didn't die in vain. And the teacher says, oh, please. Seriously? Enough with the schmaltz. She didn't make a difference. You're not going to make a difference. In the scope of human history, your life is utterly insignificant. In 50 years' time, do you think anyone will care whether you lived or died? In 100 years, do you think they'll even remember your name? And how many of you here know the name of your great-grandparents? Stick up your hand if you know the name of your great-grandparents. Maybe you're around 20%, something like that. They were probably alive 60 years ago. In 60 years' time, your own descendants won't even remember your name. Your life doesn't matter. Any other answer is just sheer romanticism. Even if you did manage to achieve incredible greatness, even if you become one of the handful who are remembered for thousands of years, what benefit of that is that to you? you're still dead, and in the end, even you, for all your greatness, will fade from people's memories. Generations come and generations go, but the earth endures forever. Well, we know now that even that was too optimistic, don't we? The earth won't endure forever. Eventually, everything, including all you've ever done and everyone you've ever helped, will be erased by the heat death of the universe. The scientists tell us that it's critical to stop global warming, that it may in fact already be too late to save the Maldives and the Great Barrier Reef, but it might still be possible to save civilization. What nonsense. We can't save civilization. C.S. Lewis again, who was writing to a previous generation who saw the invention of the atomic bomb, says, "What were your views about the ultimate future of civilization before the atomic bomb appeared on the scene? What did you think all this effort of humanity was to come to in the end? The real answer is known to almost everyone who has even a smattering of science. Yet, oddly enough, it's hardly ever mentioned. And the real answer, almost beyond doubt, is that with or without atomic bombs, the whole story is going to end in nothing." The astronomers hold out no hope that this planet is going to be permanently inhabitable. The physicists hold out no hope that organic life is going to be a permanent possibility in any part of the material universe. Not only this Earth, but the whole show, all the suns of space, at a rundown. Nature is a sinking ship. We're done. Our goose is cooked. What you're really asking is that, you know, by our stupidity, could we possibly hurry up the process? And yeah, sure, we could. But we're not actually changing the outcome. It's like worrying that the boiler is overheating on the Titanic when it's already hit the iceberg. It's worse than the Titanic, though, because people got saved from that. But our ship is going down with all hands. Who cares if it sinks a few minutes earlier? But I'm trying to make the world a better place. Come on, give me a break. You're a footprint on the edge of the sea. As soon as you pull your foot out, it starts disappearing, and a moment later it's gone. The word that our English Bibles translate as meaningless is literally vapour. Mist. That's what you are. You're the breath on a cold morning. You hardly even exist. And all the people you're devoting your life to helping are just the same. There for a moment, gone the next, with absolutely nothing to show for it. So the important question is not whether civilization can be saved. It can't. The important question is whether life under the sun, life before we all end up under the ground, is all that there is. Because if it is, then nothing matters. Everything will end in death. And neither you nor anyone else will gain anything. The third position is existentialism. This is the position made popular by Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus, among others, in the 50s and 60s. I mentioned before Sartre's novel Nausea. And at the end of it, the main character, Antoine, he realises that his life is meaningless, but he comes to see that not as a threat, but as an opportunity. His life is meaningless, but now he's actually free to make his own meaning. More than that, he has a responsibility to triumph over life's meaninglessness by creating meaning. Let the world be sensible. Let the world be senseless. I will be sensible. Yes, life is meaningless and cruel, so you've got to be courageous. You've got to live a life of morality and goodness in the face of the absurdity of it all. I will be noble. I will work for justice. The world may be cruel and senseless, but I will not live that way. It sounds noble, and it makes for great and inspiring speeches. But in the end, that's all it's got. It's just rhetoric that attempts to sidestep your mind and go straight to your heart. Because the moment it goes through your mind, you realise how stupid it is. If life really is meaningless, you can't create meaning by refusing to admit reality. All that does is make you not only meaningless, but deluded. Deciding to make your own meaning doesn't work, any more than deciding that you can fly enables you to defy gravity. You're just not dealing with reality. Far from creating meaning, you've become mad. And the teacher actually tries madness in verse 17. He says, "Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly, but I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind." See what he's saying? I tried wisdom, but that didn't solve the problem. So I tried madness, but that didn't solve it either. And being crazy as an intentional rebellion against the meaninglessness of the universe doesn't work. How could it? The teacher is pushing and pushing and pushing us to see that when it comes to life, there is no middle ground. Either this life is all there is. You've come from nothing. Your death is just the end. Nothing you do matters. Everything is futile. Life is meaningless. Or there is more to life than this life. There's a God who created you, who sustains you, who will pass judgment on what you've done, and who can raise you from the dead. And how can the atheist idea that we're just meaningless accidents and that we're all heading down the path of annihilation fit with any of the things that we care about? How can it fit with human rights or dealing with global warming, feeding the hungry, or even something just as simple and basic as love? It doesn't make sense. If your origin is meaningless and your destiny is meaningless, have the guts to admit that your life is meaningless. But conversely, if you really do believe that your life is meaningful, that your choices matter, that people should be cared for and loved, then have the courage to admit that there's a creator, that there's a God who raises the dead, and put your trust in him. Now, what is the meaning of life? What does this all mean for us? I hope that what you've seen is that it means we can't just keep doing what almost everyone does. You can't just carry on through life without thinking about it. Either you know God and you're totally on board with him, or everything is meaningless. In the ancient world, the meaning of life was a big question, and various philosophical schools put forward their different views, views of what life was all about. It's reason, it's logos, to use the Greek word. What is the logos of life? Because if you don't know the logos of life, you won't be able to live the way life was made to be. You'll never experience its full potential. You'll just be someone who's trying to use it for the wrong purpose, like someone trying to use an espresso machine as a heater. It's madness. It doesn't work. You'll never experience life's full potential unless you know its logos, its reason. So what is it? Is it having a good time? Is it trying to do what's good? Is it honouring your parents? If we could just find the logos of life, then we'd be okay. And that's what the different Greek philosophical schools were wrestling with. And into that environment, one of the original followers of Jesus, a man called John, wrote these words at the start of his biography of Jesus. "In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. The Logos became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." What's the Logos? What's the reason of life? What's it all about? Well, it turns out that it's not a philosophy. It's not a theorem. It's not a school of thought or an ideology. The Logos of life is a person. And when you know this person, when you worship this person, when you see his glory and delight in his truth, when you commit yourself to him, well, you found the Logos, the meaning of life. He's saying the meaning of life is Jesus. Because if you know him, you know God. He is God. And when you realise that, everything else just falls into place. You see that your sense that life is meaningful is right. You're not the meaningless product of time plus chance. You're a creature made by a creator with real significance and real purpose. And death is not the end. It's not the destroyer of all meaning. Because Jesus has risen from the dead, conquering it for all of us. And in doing that, he's shown us what we were made for. Not a fleeting, meaningless life, but eternal relationship with God. Now, some of you might be secularists. You don't really believe that there's any God, or you basically live as if there's not. It's worth realising then that you actually have no basis for kindness and justice and love. And yet you're living that way. You're living as if there is a God. You have to, because you instinctively know that it's true. You instinctively live as though life is not meaningless, because although you reject him, there is a God who made you and loves you and offers you eternal life. You're living off his capital without actually acknowledging him as Lord. You know he's there, so stop using him and turn to him. Start thinking. Start reading the Bible and getting to know Jesus. Because as you do that, you'll discover in him the fulfillment of your deep-seated sense that life is meaningful. You'll actually discover what life is all about. It's knowing Jesus. Some of you call yourselves Christians, but you're not really living with Jesus as your Lord. You're actually relying on something else for your meaning in life. It might be your studies, it might be your intellect, your boyfriend or girlfriend, even something as basic as your sense of humour. You're treating them as if they're God instead of delighting in Jesus as God. But when you really know Jesus, when your delight in life comes from knowing him, you can actually enjoy him and enjoy all the other things in life as well. You can enjoy them as good gifts from God instead of worshipping them as if they are God. You can let Jesus take the weight of making your life meaningful instead of putting that weight onto something that can't possibly bear it. Everything else will be taken away from you by death. Doesn't matter what it is. All your achievements, all your possessions, all your friends will be stripped away from you by death. They can't bear the weight of making your life meaningful. But Jesus can. They all get taken away by death, but your relationship with Jesus won't. Knowing him is actually what life is all about. Knowing him is what makes life meaningful.